found shelter. We'd been lured into a trap, of which the parrot bombs were only the first component. Now that our best weapon had been stripped from us, the whites were making their final assault. There was a panicked scramble as others looked around the wall to see the charging horde for themselves.
"What do we do?" cried Horace.
"We fight," said Bronwyn.
"Give him everything we've got!"
"No, we must run while we can," said Miss Avocet,
whose bent back and deeply lined face made it hard to imagine her running from anything.
"We can't afford to lose another peculiar life."
"Excuse me, but I was asking Jacob," said Horace. "He got us this far, after all."
Instinctively, I looked to Miss Peregrine, whom I considered the final authority on matters of authority. She returned my gaze and nodded.
"Yes," she said. "I think Mr. Portman should decide. Quickly, though, or the whites will make the decision for you."
I nearly protested. My hollows were all dead but one, but I suppose this was Miss Peregrine's way of saying she believed in me, hollows or no. Anyway, what we should do seemed obvious. In 100 years, the peculiars had never been so close to destroying the white menace, and if we ran away now, I knew that chance may never come again. My friends' faces were scared but determined, ready, I thought, to risk their lives for a chance to finally eradicate the white scourge. "We fight," I said. "We've come too far to give up now." If there was someone among us who would rather have fled, they stayed quiet. Even the Imbruns, who had sworn oaths to keep us safe, didn't argue. They knew what sort of fate awaited any of us who were recaptured.
"You give the word," said Emma.
I craned my neck around the wall. The whites were closing fast, no more than 100 feet away now. But I wanted them closer still, close enough that we might easily knock the guns from their hands. Shots rang out. A piercing scream came from above.
"Olive!"
Emma shouted.
"They're shooting at Olive!"
We'd left the poor girl hanging up there. The whites were taking pot shots at her while she squealed and waved her limbs like a starfish. There was no time to reel her in, but we couldn't just leave her for target practice.
"Let's give them something better to shoot at," I said. "Ready?"
Their answer was resounding and affirmative. I shimmied onto the back of my crouched hollow.
"Let's go!"
I shouted. The hollow leapt to its feet, nearly bucking me off, then launched forward like a racehorse at the starting gun. We burst from behind the wall, the hollow and I leading the charge, my friends and our Imbruns close behind. I let out a screaming war cry, not so much to scare the whites as to tear down the fear that was clawing at me, and my friends did the same. The whites balked, and for a moment they couldn't seem to decide whether to keep charging or stop and shoot at us. That bought the hollow in me enough time to clear much of the open ground that separated us. It didn't take long for the whites to make up their minds. They stopped, leveled their guns at us like a firing squad, and let loose a volley of bullets. They whizzed around me, pocking the ground, lighting up my pain receptors as they slammed into the hollow. Praying it hadn't been hit anywhere vital, I sank low to shield myself behind its body and urged it forward, faster, using its tongues like extra legs to speed us on. The hollow and I closed the remaining gap in just a few seconds, my friends close behind. Then we were among them, fighting hand to hand, and the advantage was ours. While I concentrated on knocking the guns out of the whites' hands,
my friends put their peculiar talents to good use. Emma swung her hands like flaming clubs, cutting through a line of whites. Bronwyn hurled the bricks she'd gathered, then punched and pummeled the whites with her bare hands. Hugh's lone bee had recently made some friends, and as he cheered them on, "Go for the eyes, fellows!" they swirled around and dive-bombed our enemy wherever they could. So did the Imbrins, who'd turned themselves into birds after the first gunshots. Miss Peregrine was most fearsome, her huge beak and talons sending whites running, but even small, colorful Miss Bunting made herself useful, ripping one white's hair and pecking his head hard enough to make him miss the shot he was taking, which allowed Claire to leap up and bite him on the shoulder with her wide, sharp-toothed back mouth. Enoch did his part, too, revealing from under his shirt three clay men with forks for legs and knives for arms, which he sent hacking after the white's ankles. All the while, Olive shouted advice to us from her bird's-eye view.
"Behind you, Emma! He's going for his gun, Hugh!"
Despite all our peculiar ingenuity, however, we were outnumbered, and the whites were fighting as if their lives depended on it, which likely they did. Something hard crashed into my head, the butt of a gun, and I hung limp from the hollow's back for a moment, the world spinning around me. Miss Bunting was caught and thrown to the ground. It was chaos, awful, bloody chaos, and the whites were beginning to take the momentum, forcing us back. And then, from behind me, I heard a familiar roar. My senses returning, I looked and saw Bentham, galloping toward the fight astride the back of his Grimbear. Both were soaking wet, having come through the Panlupticon the same way Emma and I had.
"Hello, young man!" he called, riding up next to me. "In need of some assistance?"
Before I could reply, my hollow was shot again, the bullet passing through the side of its neck and grazing my thigh, painting a bloody line through my torn pants.
"Yes, please!"
I shouted.
"P.T., you heard the boy!"
Bentham said.
"Kill!"
The bear dove into the fight, swinging his giant paws and knocking whites aside like they were bowling pins. One ran up and shot P.T. point-blank in the chest with a small handgun. The bear seemed merely annoyed, then picked up the white and sent him flying. Soon, with my hollow and Bentham's grim working together, we had the whites on the defensive. When we'd picked off enough of them that it became clear they were outnumbered, their ranks whittled to no more than 10, they took off and ran.
"Don't let them escape!" Emma cried.
We tore after the whites on foot, on wing, on bareback and hollowback. We chased them through the smoking ruins of the Parrot House, across ground stippled with catapulted rodents from Sharon's insurrection, toward an arched gate built into the looming outer wall. Miss Peregrine screamed overhead, dive-bombing fleeing whites. She pulled one off his feet by the back of his neck, but this and more attacks from Hugh's bees only made the 9 that were left run even faster. Their lead was growing, and my hollow was beginning to fail, leaking black fluid from a half-dozen wounds. The whites crashed on blindly, the gate's iron portcullis rising as they neared it.
"Stop them!"
I shouted, hoping that beyond the gate, Sharon and his unruly crowd might hear. And then I realized. The bridge! There was still another hollow ghast left. The one inside the bridge. If I could get control of him in time, maybe I could stop the whites from escaping. But no, they were already through the gate, running up the bridge, and I was hopelessly behind. By the time I passed through the gate, the bridge hollow had already picked up and tossed five of them across to Smoking Street, where only a thin crowd of Ambro addicts was lingering, not enough to stop them. The four whites who hadn't yet crossed were stuck at the bridge gap, waiting their turn to be flung. As my hollow and I started running up the bridge, I felt the bridge hollow come online inside me. It was picking up three of the four whites and lifting them across.
"Stop,"
I said aloud in hollow. Or at least that's what I thought I said, though maybe something got lost in translation, and maybe stop sounds a lot like drop in hollow speak. Because rather than stopping midair and then bringing the three kicking and terrified whites back to our side of the bridge, the hollow simply let them go. How strange! All the peculiars on our side of the chasm and the addicts on the other side came to the edge to watch them fall, howling and flailing all the way down through layers of sulfurous green mist until,
ploop,
they plunged into the boiling river and disappeared. A cheer went up on both sides, and a grating voice I recognized said,
"Serves him right. They were lousy tippers anyway."
It was one of two bridgeheads that were still on their pikes.
"Didn't your mum ever tell you not to swim on a full stomach?"
said the other.
"Wait 20 minutes!"
The lone white remaining on our side threw down his gun and raised his hands in surrender, while the five who'd made it across were quickly vanishing into a cloud of ash the wind had kicked up. We stood watching them go. There was no way we'd catch them now.
"Curse our luck," Bentham said. "Even that small number of whites could wreak havoc for years to come."
"Agreed, brother. Though honestly, I didn't realize you gave a titmouse what happened to the rest of us." We turned to see Miss Peregrine walking toward us, returned to human form, a shawl clasped modestly around her shoulders. Her eyes were locked on Bentham, her expression sour and unwelcoming.
"Hello, Alma. Fantastic to see you," he said with overeager cheerfulness. "And of course I give a..." He cleared his throat awkwardly. "Why, I'm the reason you're not still in a prison cell. Go on, children, tell them."
"Mr. Bentham helped us a lot," I admitted, though I didn't really want to insert myself into a sibling spat.
"In that case, all due thanks," Miss Peregrine said coldly. "I'll ensure the Council of Imbrins is made aware of the role you played here. Perhaps they'll see fit to lighten your sentence."
"Sentence?" Emma said, looking sharply at Bentham.
"What sentence?"
His lip twisted.
"Banishment. You don't think I'd live in this pit if I was welcome anywhere else, do you? I was framed, unjustly accused of..."
"Collusion," Miss Peregrine said. "Collaboration with the enemy. Betrayal after betrayal."
"I was acting as a double agent, Alma, mining our brother for information. I explained this to you."
He was whining, his palms out like a beggar's.
"You know I have every reason to hate Jack."
Miss Peregrine raised her hand to stop him. She'd heard this story before and didn't want to again.
"When he betrayed your grandfather," she said to me, "that was the last straw."
"It was an accident,"
Bentham said, drawing back in offense.
"Then what became of the soul you drew from him?" said Miss Peregrine.
"It was injected into the test subjects."
Miss Peregrine shook her head.
"We reverse-engineered your experiment. They were given soul from barnyard animals, which can only mean that you kept Abe's for yourself."
"What an absurd allegation!" he cried. "Is that what you told the council? That's why I'm still rotting in here, isn't it?"
I couldn't tell if he was genuinely surprised or just acting. "I knew you felt threatened by my intellect and superior leadership capabilities, but that you'd stoop to such lies to keep me out of your way. Do you know how many years I've spent fighting to eradicate the scourge of ambrosia use? What on earth would I want with that poor man's soul?"
"The same thing our brother wants with young Mr. Portman," Miss Peregrine said.
"I won't even honor that accusation with a denial. I only wish this haze of bias would clear, so that you could see the truth. I'm on your side, Alma, and I've always been."
"You're on whatever side fits your interests at the moment."
Bentham sighed and aimed a hangdog look at Emma and me. "Goodbye, children. It's been a distinct pleasure knowing you. I'll go back home now. Saving all your lives has taken quite a toll on this old man's body. But I hope one day, when your headmistress comes to her senses, we'll meet again." He tipped his hat, and he and his bear began to walk away through the crowd, back through the compound toward the tower. "What a drama queen," I muttered, though I did feel a little bad for him.
"Imbrins!"
Miss Peregrine called.
"Watch him!"
"Did he really steal Abe's soul?" Emma asked.
"Without proof we can't be certain," replied Miss Peregrine. "But the rest of his crimes taken together would earn him more than a lifetime's banishment." Watching him go, her hard expression gradually melted away.
"My brother's taught me a hard lesson. No one can hurt you as badly as the people you love."
The wind shifted, sending the ash cloud that had aided the whites' escape in our direction. It came faster than we could react, the air around us howling and stinging, the daylight dimming away. There was a sharp flutter of wings as the Imbrins changed form and flew up above the storm. My hollow sank to its knees, bowed its head, and shielded its face with its two free tongues. It was accustomed to ash storms, but our friends were not. I could hear them panicking in the dark.
"Stay where you are!" I shouted. "It'll pass!" "Everyone breathe through your shirts!" said Emma.
When the storm began to subside a little, I heard something from across the bridge that made the hairs on my neck stand up. It was three baritone voices united in a song, the lines of which were punctuated by thuds and groans.
"Hark to the clinking of hammers! Thwack! Hark to the driving of nails!
Gah! My legs!
What fun to build a gallows!
Let me go! Let me go!
The cure for all that ails!
Please no more! I give up!"
And then, as the ash began to clear, Sharon and his three burly cousins appeared, each of them dragging a subdued wight.
"Morning, all," Sharon called. "Did you lose something?"
Wiping ash from their eyes, our friends saw what they'd done and began to cheer.
"Sharon, you brilliant man!" shouted Emma.
All around us the Imbrins were landing and resuming human form. As they slipped quickly into the clothes they'd dropped, we respectfully kept our eyes on the whites. Suddenly, one of them broke away from his captor and ran. Rather than chasing him, the rigger calmly selected a small hammer from his tool belt, planted his feet, and threw it. It tumbled end over end straight toward the white's head, but what would have been a perfect takedown was spoiled when the white ducked. He darted toward the chaos of scrap at the road's edge.
Just as the white was about to disappear between two shanty houses, a crack in the road erupted, and the white was engulfed in a belch of yellow flame. Though it was a grisly sight, everyone whooped and cheered.
"You see," said Sharon, "the acre itself wants to be rid of them."
"That's wonderful," I said, "but what about Carl?" "I agree," said Emma. "None of these victories will matter if we can't catch him. Right, Miss P?" I glanced around, but didn't see her. Emma looked, too, her eyes scanning the crowd. "Miss Peregrine?" she said, panic creeping into her voice. I made my hollow stand tall so I could get a better view. "Does anyone see Miss Peregrine?" I shouted. Now everyone was looking, checking the sky in case she was still airborne, the ground in case she'd landed but not yet turned human. Then, from behind us, a high, gleeful shout cut through our chatter.
"Look no further, children!"
For a moment, I couldn't pinpoint the voice. It came again.
"Do as I say, and no harm will come to her."
Then I saw emerge from beneath the branches of a small, ash-blackened tree just inside the White's gate, a familiar figure. Call. A twig of a man with no weapons in his hand nor guards by his side. His face pale and contorted into an unnatural grin. His eyes capped by bulging sunglasses, insectine. He was dandied up in a cloak, a cape, loops of gold jewelry, and a bouffant silk tie. He looked flamboyantly insane, like some mad doctor from Gothic fiction who'd performed too many experiments on himself. And it was his evident madness, I think, and that we all knew him to be capable of true evil, that stopped us from rushing to tear him apart. A man like Call was never as defenseless as he seemed.
"Where's Miss Peregrine?"
I shouted, inspiring a chorus of similar demands from the Imbrins and Peculiars behind me.
"Right where she belongs," Call said. "With her family."
The last of the ash cloud gusted out of the compound behind him, revealing Bentham and Miss Peregrine, the latter in human form, held captive in the arms of Bentham's bear. Though her eyes flashed with rage, she knew better than to struggle against a sharp-clawed, short-tempered grim bear. It seemed a recurring nightmare we were doomed to dream again and again. Miss Peregrine kidnapped, this time by Bentham. He stood slightly behind the bear with eyes downcast, as if ashamed to meet our looks. Cries of shock and anger rippled through the Peculiars and Imbrins.
"Bentham!"
I shouted.
"Let her go!" "You traitorous bastard!"
cried Emma. Bentham raised his head to look at us.
"As recently as 10 minutes ago," he said in a high and imperious tone, "you had my loyalty. I could have betrayed you to my brother days ago, but I didn't."
He narrowed his eyes at Miss Peregrine.
"I chose you, Alma, because I believed, naively it seems, that if I helped you and your wards, you might see how unfairly you'd judged me, might finally rise above past differences and let bygones be bygones."
"You'll be sent to the pitiless waste for this," Miss Peregrine shouted.
"I'm not frightened of your little council anymore,"
Bentham said.
"You won't keep me down any longer."
He stamped his cane.
"Petey! Muzzle!"
The bear clamped its paw over Miss Peregrine's face. Call strode toward his brother and sister, his arms and smile spreading.
"Benny's made a choice to stand up for himself, and I, for one, congratulate him. There's nothing like a family reunion."
Suddenly, Bentham was pulled back by an unseen force. A knife flashed at his throat.
"Make the bear release Miss Peregrine, or else!"
a familiar voice shouted.
"Millard!"
someone gasped, one of many that rippled through our crowd. It was Millard, disrobed and invisible. Bentham looked terrified, but Call seemed merely annoyed. He drew an antique pepperbox pistol from one of the deep pockets in his cloak and pointed it at Bentham's head.
"Let her go, and I'll kill you, brother."
"We made a pact!"
Bentham protested.
"And you caving to the demands of a nude boy with a dull knife would be breaking that pact."
Call cocked the gun, walked it forward until it was pressed against Bentham's temple, and addressed Millard.
"If you make me kill my only brother, consider your Imbrin dead, too."
Millard hesitated for a moment, then dropped the knife and ran. Call made a grab for him but missed, and Millard's footsteps curved away in a trail of divots. Bentham composed himself and straightened his mussed shirt. Call, his good humor gone, turned the gun on Miss Peregrine.
"Now listen to me," he barked. "You there, across the bridge, let those guards go."
They had little choice but to do as he asked. Sharon and his cousins released their collared whites and backed away, and the white who'd been standing on our side of the bridge lowered his hands and picked his gun up off the ground. Within seconds, the balance of power had been reversed completely, and there were four guns aimed at the crowd and one at Miss Peregrine. Call could do what he wanted.
"Boy!"
he said, pointing at me.
"Pitch that hollow into the chasm!"
His shrill voice, a needle in my eardrum. I walked my hollow to the edge of the chasm.
"Now make him leap!"
It seemed I didn't have a choice. It was an awful waste, but perhaps just as well. The hollow was suffering badly now, its wounds leaking black blood that flowed around its feet. It wouldn't have survived. I unwrapped its tongue from my waist, unsaddled myself, and stepped down. My strength had returned enough for me to stand on my own, but the hollows was going fast. As soon as I was off its back, it bellowed softly, sucked its tongues back into its mouth, and sank to its knees. A willing sacrifice. "Thank you, whoever you were," I said. "I'm sure that if you'd ever become a white, you wouldn't have been a completely evil one." I put my foot on its back and pushed. The hollow tumbled forward and dropped silently into the misty void. After a few seconds, I felt its consciousness disappear from my mind. The whites across the bridge rode over to our side on the hollow's tongues. Miss Peregrine's life threatened again if I interfered. Olive was yanked out of the sky. The guards set about herding us into a tight and easily controllable cluster. Then Call shouted for me, and one of the guards reached into the crowd and dragged me out.
"He's the only one we really need alive," Call said to his guards. "If you must shoot him in the knees. As for the rest of them..."
Call swung his gun toward the tightly packed crowd and fired. There were screams as the crowd surged.
"Shoot them anywhere you please!"
He laughed and twirled with his arms poised like a squat ballerina. I was about to run at him,
ready to dig out his eyes with my bare hands and damn the consequences, when a long-barreled revolver appeared front and center in my field of view.
"Don't,"
grunted my monosyllabic guard, a white with broad shoulders and a shiny bald head. Call fired his own gun into the air and shouted for quiet, and every voice fell away but the whimpers of whomever he'd shot.
"Don't cry! I have a treat for you people,"
he said, addressing the crowd.
"This is a historic day. My brother and I are about to culminate a lifetime's worth of innovation and struggle by crowning ourselves the twin kings of peculiardom. And what would a coronation be without witnesses? So we're bringing you along. Provided you behave yourselves, you'll see something no one has witnessed for 1,000 years. The domination and expropriation of the Library of Souls.
You have to promise one thing, or I won't help you, I said to Call. I didn't have much negotiating power, but he believed he needed me, and that was something. Once you get what you want, let Miss Peregrine go.
I'm afraid that won't do, Call said. But I'll let her live. Peculiardom will be more fun to rule with my sister in it. Once I clip your wings, I'll keep you as my personal slave, Alma.
How would you like that? She tried to respond, but her words were lost beneath the bear's meaty paw. Call cupped a hand behind his ear and laughed.
What's that? I can't hear you!
Then he turned and began walking toward the tower.
Let's go!
The guards shouted, and soon we were all stumbling after him. Chapter 9. We were herded toward the pale tower at a brutal pace, the whites encouraging stragglers with shoves and kicks. Without my hollow, I was a limping, hobbling mess. I had nasty bite wounds across my torso, and the dust that had kept me from feeling them was beginning to wear off. I forced myself forward anyway, my mind spinning out ways we might save ourselves, each more implausible than the last. Without my hollows, all our peculiar powers were outmatched by the whites and their guns. We stumbled past the wrecked building where my hollows had died, over bricks misted with the blood of parrots and whites, marched through the walled courtyard, into the tower door, and then up and up its winding hallway, past a blur of identical black doors. Call paraded before us like a deranged bandleader, high-stepping and swinging his arms one moment, and turning to hurl profane insults at us the next. Behind him, the bear waddled along with Bentham riding in the crook of one arm, and Miss Peregrine slung over its shoulder. She pled with her brothers to reconsider their course of action.
"Remember the old stories of Abaddon, and the ignominious end that came to every peculiar who stole the library's souls. Its power is cursed."
"I'm not a child anymore, Alma, and I'm no longer frightened by old Imbrin's tales," Call scoffed. "Now hold your tongue. That is, if you want to keep it."
She soon gave up trying to convince them, and stared silently at us over the bear's shoulder, her face projecting strength.
"Don't be afraid," she seemed to telegraph. "We'll survive this, too."
I worried not all of us would survive even the trip to the top of the tower. Turning around, I tried to see who it was that had been shot. Amidst the tight-packed group behind me, Bronwyn was carrying someone limp in her arms, Miss Avocet, I think,
and then a meaty hand smacked me in the head.
"Face forward or lose a kneecap," growled my guard.
Finally, we came to the top of the tower and its very last door. In the hallway beyond, pale daylight shone on the curving wall. There was an open deck above us, a fact I filed away for future reference. Call stood beaming before the door.
"Perplexus!" he called. "Signor Anomalous? Yes, there in the back. Since I owe this discovery in part to your expeditions and hard work, credit where credit is due, I think you should do the honors and open the door."
"Come now, we've no time for ceremony," said Bentham. "We've left your compound unguarded."
"Don't be such a ninny-willow," Call said. "This won't take but a moment."
One of the guards dragged Perplexus out of the crowd and up to the door. Since I'd last seen him, his hair and beard had turned alabaster white, his spine had curved, and deep wrinkles grooved his face. He'd spent too long away from his loop, and now his true age was beginning to catch up to him. Perplexus seemed about to open the door when he was struck by a fit of coughing. Once he'd regained his breath, he faced Call, drew in a snorting lungful of air, and spat a glistening wad of phlegm onto his cloak.
"You are an ignorant pig!" Perplexus cried.
Call raised his pistol to Perplexus's head and pulled the trigger. There were screams.
"Jack, don't!"
Bentham shouted, and Perplexus threw up his hands and spun away. But the only sound the gun made was a dry click. Call opened the gun and peered into its chamber, then shrugged.
"It's an antique, like yourself," he said to Perplexus, then used its barrel to flick the spittle from his jacket. "I suppose fate has intervened on your behalf. Just as well. I'd rather watch you turn to dust than bleed to death."
He motioned for the guards to take him away. Perplexus, muttering oaths at Call in Italian, was dragged back to the group. Call turned to the door.
"Oh, to hell with it,"
he muttered, and opened it.
"Get in there, all of you!"
Inside was the same familiar gray-walled room, only this time its missing fourth wall extended into a long, dark corridor. With a few shoves from the guards, we were hurrying along it. The smooth walls became rough and uneven, then widened into a primitive, daylit room. The room was made from rock and clay, and I might have called it a cave, but for its approximately rectangular door and two windows. Someone had carved them and this room using tools to dig it out of soft rock. We were herded outside into a hot, dry day. The view opened dizzyingly. We were high in a landscape that could have been an alien world. Everywhere around us, towering on one side and rolling away into valleys on the other, were humps and spires of strange reddish rock, all honeycombed with crude doors and windows. A constant wind blew through them, producing a human-sounding moan that seemed to emanate from the earth itself. Though the sun was nowhere near setting, the sky glowed orange, as if the end of the world were brewing just beyond the horizon. And despite evidence here of a civilization, other than ourselves, there was no one in sight. I had a heavy, watched feeling, like we were trespassing someplace we were not meant to be. Bentham climbed down from his bear and removed his hat in awe.
"So, this is the place,"
he said, gazing across the hills.
Call threw a big brotherly arm across his shoulders.
I told you this day would come. We certainly put each other through hell getting here, didn't we?
We did, Bentham agreed.
But I say all's well that ends well. Because now I get to do this.
Call turned to face us.
Friends, Imbrins, peculiar children!
He let his voice echo away into the strange, moaning canyons.
Today we'll go down in history. Welcome to Abaddon!
He paused, waiting for applause that didn't come.
You're standing now in the ancient city that once protected the Library of Souls. Until recently, it hadn't been seen in over 400 years, nor conquered in 1,000, until I rediscovered it. Now, with you as my witnesses.
He stopped, looked down for a moment, then laughed.
Why am I wasting my breath? You Philistines will never appreciate the gravity of my achievements. Look at you, like donkeys contemplating the Sistine Chapel.
He patted Bentham on the arm.
Come on, brother. Let's go and take what's ours.
And ours as well, said a voice behind me. One of the guards. You won't forget us, will you, sir?
Of course I won't, Call said, attempting a smile, and failing.
He couldn't disguise his irritation at having been challenged in front of everyone.
Your loyalty will be repaid tenfold.
He turned with Bentham and started down a footpath, the guards pushing us after them. The sun-baked path split and split again, sending branches and feeders into the spiked hills. Following a route he'd no doubt forced Perplexus to reveal and had trod many times in recent days, Call led us down obscure and bramble-choked lanes with certainty, his every step oozing the arrogance of a colonizer. The watched feeling I had only grew, as if the rough openings bored into the rock were a colony of half-closed eyes, some ancient intelligence encased in stone, waking slowly from 1,000-year sleep. I was fevered with anxiety, my thoughts tripping over one another. What happened next would be up to me. The whites needed me, after all. What if I refused to handle the souls for them? What if I found a way to trick them? I knew what would happen. Call would kill Miss Peregrine. Then he'd start killing the other Imbrins, one after another, until I gave him what he wanted. And if I didn't, he'd kill Emma. I wasn't strong enough. I knew I'd do anything to stop them from hurting her, even hand Call the keys to untold power. Then I had a thought that scared the bejesus out of me. What if I couldn't do it? What if Call was wrong and I couldn't see the soul jars, or I could see them but not handle them? He wouldn't believe me. He'd think I was lying. He'd start murdering my friends. And even if I somehow convinced him it was true, that I couldn't, he might get so livid that he'd kill everyone anyway. I said a silent prayer to my grandfather. Can you pray to dead people? Well, I did, and I asked if he was watching me, to see me through this, and to make me as strong and as powerful as he once was. Grandpa Portman, I prayed. I know this sounds crazy,
but Emma and my friends mean the world to me. The whole damned world. And I would gladly give every bit of it to Call in exchange for their lives. Does that make me evil? I don't know, but I thought you might understand. So please.
Looking up, I was surprised to see Miss Peregrine watching me from over the bear's shoulder. As soon as she met my eyes, she looked away, and I could see tears tracking through the grime on her pale cheeks, as if somehow she'd heard me. Our route wound through an ancient maze of twisting paths and stairways cut into the hills, their steps worn into crescent moons. In some places the path all but disappeared, swallowed by weeds. I heard Perplexus complain that it had taken him years to puzzle out the way to the Library of Souls, and to have this ungrateful thief tromping along it now with no regard, a terrible insult. And then I heard Olive say,
"Why did no one ever tell us the library was real?"
"Because, my dear," replied an Imbrin, "it wasn't allowed. It was safer to say..."
The Imbrin paused to catch her breath.
"That it was just a story."
Just a story. It had become one of the defining truths of my life that, no matter how I tried to keep them flattened, two-dimensional, jailed in paper and ink, there would always be stories that refused to stay bound inside books. It was never just a story. I would know. A story had swallowed my whole life. We'd been walking for several minutes along a plain-looking wall, the wind's eerie moan rising and falling, when Call raised a hand and shouted for everyone to stop.
"Have we gone too far?" he said. "I could have sworn the grotto was along here somewhere. Where's the cartographer?"
Perplexus was hauled forth from the crowd.
"Aren't you glad you didn't shoot him?"
Bentham muttered. Call ignored him.
"Where's the grotto?"
he demanded, getting in Perplexus's face.
"Ah, perhaps it's hidden itself from you,"
Perplexus teased.
"Don't test me," Call replied. "I'll burn every copy of your map of days. Your name will be forgotten by next year."
Perplexus knotted his fingers together and sighed.
"There,"
he said, pointing behind us. We had passed it. Call stomped down to a vine-choked patch of wall, an opening so humble and well hidden that anyone might have missed it, not so much a door as a hole. He pushed aside the vines and poked his head through.
"Yes,"
I heard him say, and then he pulled out his head again and began giving orders.
"Essential persons only are allowed past this point. Brother, sister..."
He pointed at Bentham and Miss Peregrine.
"Boy,"
he pointed at me.
"Two guards, and..."
He searched the crowd.
"It's dark in there. We'll need a flashlight. You, girl,"
he pointed at Emma. As my stomach turned knots, Emma was pulled out of the group.
"The others give you trouble," Call said to the guards. "You know what to do."
Call raised his pistol at the crowd. They all screamed and ducked their heads. Call howled with laughter. Emma's guard pushed her through the hole. Bentham's bear would never fit through, so Miss Peregrine was set down, and my white given double duty guarding both her and me. The youngest children began to weep. Who knew if they would ever see her again?
"Be brave, children," Miss Peregrine called to them. "I'll be back."
"That's right, children," Call sang mockingly. "Listen to your headmistress. Imbrin knows best."
Miss Peregrine and I were pushed through the opening together, and there was a moment, tangled in the vines, when I was able to whisper to her unnoticed.
"What should I do when we get inside?"
"Anything he asks,"
she whispered back.
"If we don't anger him, we may yet survive."
Survive, yes, but at what cost? And then we were parting the vines and stumbling into a strange new space, a stone room open to the sky. For an instant, my breath abandoned me, so shocked was I by the giant, misshapen face staring back at us from the opposite wall. A wall, that's all it was, but one with a gaping mouth for a door, two warped eyes for windows, a pair of holes for nostrils, and grown over with long grass that resembled hair and an unruly beard. The moaning wind was louder than ever here, as if the mouth-shaped door were trying to warn us away in some ancient language made of vowels a week long. Call indicated the door.
"The library awaits."
Bentham removed his hat.
"Extraordinary," he said,
hushed and reverent.
"It almost seems to be singing to us. Like all the resting souls here are coming awake to welcome us."
"Welcoming," said Emma. "I doubt that."
The guards pushed us toward the door. We ducked through the low opening and into another cave-like room. Like the others we'd seen in Abaton, it had been dug by hand from soft rock, untold ages ago. It was low-ceilinged and bare, empty but for some scattered straw and broken shards of pottery. Its most unique feature was the walls, into which had been dug many dozens of small coves. They were oval-topped and flat on the bottom, large enough to hold a bottle or a candle. At the back of the room, several doors forked away into darkness.
"Well, boy," said Call, "can you see any?"
I looked around.
"Any what?"
"Don't trifle with me. Soul jars."
He stepped to a wall and swept his hand inside one of the coves.
"Go and pick one up."
I turned slowly, scanning the walls. Every cove appeared to be empty.
"I don't see anything," I said. "Maybe there aren't any."
"You're lying."
Call nodded to my guard. The guard punched me in the stomach. Emma and Miss Peregrine shouted as I fell to my knees, groaning. Looking down at myself, I saw blood trickling through my shirt, not from the punch, but from my hollow bite.
"Please, Jack," cried Miss Peregrine. "He's just a boy."
"Just a boy! Just a boy!"
Call said mockingly.
"That's the very heart of the problem. You've got to punish them like men. Water them with a bit of blood, and then the shoot begins to spring up, the plant to grow."
He strode toward me while spinning the barrel of his odd antique pistol.
"Straighten his leg. I want a clean shot at the knee."
The guard shoved me to the ground and grabbed a hold of my calf, my cheek ground into the dirt, my face aimed at the wall. I heard the gun's hammer pull back, and then, as the women begged Call for mercy, I saw something in one of the coves in the wall, a shape I hadn't noticed before.
"Wait!"
I shouted.
"I see something!"
The guard flipped me over.
"Come to your senses, have you?"
Call was standing over me, looking down. "What do you see?" I looked again, blinking, forced myself to be calm, my vision to focus. There in the wall, coming gradually into view like a Polaroid photo, was the faint image of a stone jar. It was a simple, unadorned thing, cylindrical in shape, with a tapered neck and a cork plugging its top, its stone the same reddish color as the strange hills of Abaton. "It's a jar," I said. "Just one. It was tipped over, that's why I didn't notice it at first."
"Stand," Call said. "I want to see you pick it up."
I drew my knees to my chest, rocked forward onto my feet, and stood, pain rioting through my midsection. I shuffled across the room and reached slowly into the cove. I slid my fingers around the jar, then got a shock and pulled my hand away.
"What is it?" Call said.
"It's freezing," I replied. "I wasn't expecting it."
"Fascinating," murmured Bentham.
He'd been lingering near the door as if reconsidering this whole endeavor, but now he took a step closer. I reached into the cove again, ready for the cold this time, and removed the jar.
"This is wrong," Miss Peregrine said. "There's a peculiar soul in there, and it should be treated with respect."
"To be eaten by me would be the greatest respect a soul could be paid," Call said.
He came and stood next to me.
"Describe the jar."
"It's very simple. Made of stone." It was starting to freeze my right hand, so I passed it to my left, and then I saw, written across the back in tall, spidery letters, a word. Aswindan. I wasn't going to mention it, but Call was watching me like a hawk, and had seen me notice something.
"What is it?" he demanded. "I warn you, hold nothing back!"
"It's a word," I said. "Aswindan."
"Spell it."
A-S-W-I-N-D-A-N.
"Aswindan," Call said, his brow furrowing. "That's old peculiar, isn't it?" "Obviously," Bentham said. "Don't you remember your lessons?" "Of course I do! I was a quicker study than you, remember?" "Aswindan. The root is wind, which doesn't refer to the weather, but denotes quickness, as in quickening, as in strengthening, invigoration."
"I'm not so sure about that, brother."
"Oh, you're not!" Call said sarcastically. "I think you want it for yourself!"
Call reached out and tried to snatch the jar from me. He managed to get his fingers around it, but as soon as the jar left my hand, his fingers closed on themselves, as if there were suddenly nothing between them, and the jar dropped to the floor and smashed. Call swore and looked down, dumbfounded, as blue and brightly glowing liquid puddled at our feet.
"I can see it now,"
he said excitedly, pointing at the blue puddle.
"That I can see!"
"Yes. Yes, me too," said Bentham, and the guards concurred.
They could all see the liquid, but not the jars that contained and protected it. One of the guards bent down to graze the blue liquid with his finger. The moment he touched it, he cried out and jumped back, flapping his hand to shake the stuff off. If the jar was freezing, I could only imagine how cold the blue stuff was.
"What a waste," Call said.
I would have liked to combine that with a few other choice souls.
Aswindan, Bentham recited. Root word, swind, meaning shrink.
Be glad you didn't take that one, brother.